Papermen meet such interesting people.
Coming up on this week's Media Project, we'll be talking about the president's press conference, protections for journalists, and a big merger between a newspaper and public radio in Chicago. That's all on the Media Project. Join Alan Shartok, Rosemary Romero, Judy Patrick, and me, Ira Fussfeld, filling in for Rex Smith, coming up next.
See, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
And welcome to another edition of the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. This is our weekly look about all things media, except when we find something else that we think is interesting. We hope to provide you some insight and some information and maybe even a little humor. And we'll do that with me leading the way this week. I'm Ira Fussfeld, the retired publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, sitting in for Rex Smith. Alan Shartok is here, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, among other long things on his curricula vitae, is that what they call it? Yeah, Judy Patrick is here, former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, New York, and current vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and UAlbany professor, is here as well. Welcome all. Rosemary is calling in from Florida, and Rex Smith, who would normally be here in this chair, is, at least based on pictures he's posting, somewhere in the far northeast, bicycling in the snow. You decide who's made the better choice. I vote for Rosemary. We have a variety of subjects. I'll start with a little bit of a somber note. The attacks on journalism, attacks on journalists, attacks on press freedom. In 2021, there were documented 142 assaults of journalists, and most of these assaults came during protests. There was also a number of reports of damaged equipment and the like, troubling numbers. And now we have a potential solution, or at least a hope for a solution, offered by someone named Erin Carroll in the Columbia Journalism Review, who is suggesting that they pass a law that it would be unlawful to obstruct journalists. We've heard of obstruction of justice. This person believes there should be obstruction of journalism. I have a lot of details on that, but I'd rather the other folks talk. What's your initial response to something like that, Alan?
Well, my initial response is that there will be people who are behind that movement who darn well want to see journalists and journalism messed with. In too many cases, politicians see journalists as their natural enemies, much like the toad and whoever the toad's enemy is, which I don't know. But in any case, it is not surprising to me to see this kind of a movement in this country. You know, when we say we should pass a law protecting journalists, who do you think we're protecting them from? The very people we would call on, in some cases, to pass the law.
Rosemary, you've been in some hairy situations over the years. What's your thoughts about this?
Well, a couple. I certainly wouldn't oppose this. I don't see it having a very good chance of passing because too many people, including journalists themselves, don't want to put journalists into a special category. And we have laws already on assault and battery and, you know, threats, the sorts of things that are happening to journalists. The bigger problem to me is not from the public, which, you know, they kind of call you names and stuff. That's always happened. But it's from police. Police behavior is part of a bigger problem that's not a media issue, but a societal issue here. Reporters being hit with rubber bullets during protests or being arrested for trespass when they're trying to cover something. That's not the general public doing it. It's police. So the problem is there, and I don't think a law would really help with that.
Judy?
You know, my initial reaction is I agree with Rosemary, and journalists in general do not want to be put in a special protected class. We want you to face the same criminal liabilities if you assault us as if you would assault a regular person on the street. We don't want you to get a higher level of sentencing or increase the felony to a different class. But we do get special protections when it comes to covering protests. I mean, we get better access, but I agree. What we've seen is reporters' equipment trashed, they get shoved, they get pushed, they get injured. It's always been the case, and it's happening more and more online, which can be very dangerous as well. You know, at least, let's say, at least we do not have the President of the United States calling us the enemy of the people anymore, and I was hoping that that would tamp down the assault, at least in the United States. But it seems like here and around the world, the press is increasingly being suppressed, and it's something we can't just forget because Donald Trump is no longer in office.
Rosemary, you've done a lot of work internationally, and you've been around. Would you compare the kind of potential physical or mental threat that the press faces in the United States compared to foreign countries?
Alan, it's becoming increasingly the same. I used to feel privileged when I went to work in Bosnia or in Africa, where if you wrote something or asked a question that annoyed a politician or even a businessman, you faced an open threat. And we walked around. We had all kinds of measures in Sarajevo about protections and not following the same routine and, you know, going with a buddy and all this stuff to protect ourselves. And we used to think, wow, so glad you don't have to do this in the United States. That's not true anymore. And Donald Trump was the big reason for this. CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, named him as one of the biggest threats to press freedom in the United States during his administration. And this report to which we are referring, that Ira has read, is referring, if you'll look at it, the years are the Trump years. And I'm not so sure that it's on the increase right now. It certainly rose precipitously under Trump. We've yet to see journalists treated badly in the 1 year of the Biden administration. In fact, there have been encouraging signs under Biden, including the Department of Justice saying, okay, we're going to drop this thing about looking up your records and surveilling journalists, which Trump did actively. That's exactly what happens in third world countries, which I know we're not supposed to say anymore, but, you know, countries with less evolved economic and political systems, supposedly, than ours.
You know, to Judy's point that the current president is not acting as did the former president regarding threats to the press, but the former president is still out there, and although he's getting a lot less attention than he used to, he's still running the same old shtick, including making the press the enemy. And unfortunately, there are enough people in that relatively small but still large group who could be those who would commit violence against journalists. So it hasn't gone away, I guess, is my point. It may not be as visible, but it's still out there.
I still don't think you need special law. There are laws against whether to enforce them is the issue, but there are already laws against assault, battery, threatening bodily harm, going online and making threats. All of those we already have laws for. It's a matter of enforcing them.
Well, the proponent of the law says, unlike more generic assault or anti-threat laws, obstruction of journalism would be aimed at addressing the systemic harm that this violence causes to the press and freedom of expression. He also points out that someone mentioned how difficult it would be to get something like this passed, although I shouldn't say he, I believe the writer is a she, but she points out that there is something that has been passed called the Fallen Journalists Memorial Act, which established a monument in Washington to commemorate, quote, America's commitment to a free press and to honor journalists who sacrificed their lives in service to that cause. And the impetus for that Fallen Journalists Memorial was the massacre a couple of years ago at the Annapolis Capital Gazette. So there is some precedent for some law, but it wouldn't be easy. And as has been expressed here, it sounds like there's not necessarily unanimity even among journalists that it's something that's worth doing.
Yes, the monument would be a memorial to what happened in Annapolis. The real threat to journalism in Annapolis right now, it's not threats, it's not that crazy person who went in acting alone. It's the hedge fund that bought up the newspaper and is slowly shutting it down and draining it of resources. That's the real threat to journalism. It's also a problem for press freedom. If you don't have journalists to do the reporting, you don't have a vibrant free press.
Well, you know, we are going to be talking, I'm sure, and this might not be the worst time to start bringing it up, the mammoth two-hour press conference that Joe Biden conducted.
Yes, I'm curious to see what the group thinks, not necessarily about what policies, whether you agree or not with Biden, but the way he conducted that press conference, the length of it, which was the longest press conference in the history of presidential press conferences, and how did the press purport itself? I'll throw it back to you guys.
Well, that's right. And I was just going to say, for 2 hours, he took the worst, meanest kinds of provocative questions you could name. You know, are you mentally ill or deficient or whatever they were saying to him? And he would meet them with a smile on his face. He didn't say, take them out of here and beat them up. You know, this is a whole new regime and way of treating the press. And some of the press behavior was just awful in terms of the meaner the question, the more kudos I'm going to get for doing my job. I didn't like it one bit.
If Trump had been asked the question about his mental fitness, would you have felt the same way? I mean, it certainly was talked about on this program and elsewhere, concerns about whether that guy was all there or is all there.
As far as I'm concerned, it would have been appropriate in his case.
Judy, I noticed you at some point posted how you enjoyed watching this thing.
I did. I actually, as it went on, and then towards the end, he seemed to be calling for a lightning round of questions, although he was long-winded, so there was no lightning round, but I would have loved that. He took questions from 22 reporters. I often think of White House press conferences as more as theater than our opportunity to learn anything, but I thought it gave us a good idea of where he is. The press does like to make this a spectacle, whether or not they're really trying to get information. I think they get the nuts and bolts information every day from the Jen Psaki press conferences and other departments that have substantial press conferences. But they tried to get information from Biden about what his thinking was, and he does have inexact language. He meanders a lot, but you get a sense of what he's doing. Sometimes they ask questions there were really no answers to, and with 22 questions, they hit a lot of subjects, but I didn't hear anything about the border or about police reforms. Reporters know that sometimes you ask a question and the politician just uses as an opportunity to address the subject. Like they asked about schools dealing with the pandemic, and I didn't think, you know, they got a good answer from Biden about how schools were dealing with that. So it was not as bad as the last press conference back in March. It's been a long time where the reporters at least asked a range of questions. I love to see David Sanger from the New York Times asked a very cogent question about Ukraine, which prompted good follow-up questions from Reuters. So in general, a better press conference. I want to see more one-on-one interviews with the president and serious journalists.
Rosemary, you've been critical in the past of the White House press corps writ large. Did the press conference meet your expectations?
Oh, yeah, low expectations. I think that Biden has an extremely cogent and coherent, unlike Trump, press communication policy. He has Jen Psaki out there every day answering lots and lots of questions. I think that's really important. He is always available to the press. He answers questions. They're not formal press conferences that he's there. As Judy suggests, he probably could do better with a few more serious, in-depth interviews, but I would prefer that or nothing at all, which we have had, the sort of spectacle that we saw yesterday, asking him if he's senile. Come on, give me a break. It is absolutely fair, though, let me say, for that question to have been asked. Stupid and combative, and Rosie did himself no service. But when you hold a press conference, when you say, yeah, you can interview me, then the journalist is allowed to ask any question. And they should be asking that question of Biden as well as they did of Trump. But look at the response. That's what we as citizens should be looking at. Trump would say, get out of here. You're a nasty person. How could you ask a question like that and so on? And Biden just sort of laughed it off and said, come on, let's just move on. He's a grown-up. And I felt like that. I felt that was my favorite part, actually, of the whole thing. I do not think that press corps, you're going to get coherent answers about what we're doing in the Ukraine or how he plans to proceed on voter rights, which it just isn't going to happen in that setting.
Let me ask a question of all of you, and that is this. You know, I'm very interested watching it as a political scientist to know whether the questioner is reflective of whether it's a conservative paper or a liberal paper, you know. So my question is this. Should the person be identified with the paper every time so that we have an idea of where these questions are coming from?
You mean when a reporter gets up, they should identify themselves?
Yes. And their paper.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. It's not good television. It's not informative to not identify who these people are. He does call on them by name, so there were some who were identified, but there's several I was unfamiliar with.
And what did you think about the list? Is that a good idea to say we've pre-chosen the questions, the people who will ask the questions?
If you remember, Kathy Hochul did the same thing at her first press conference. I mean, there were only 20 or there were a limited number of reporters in the room anyway. And it turns out I think almost everybody got a chance to ask a question. I think it's unreasonable for us to expect the president to know the name of every single reporter in the room. He probably knows a lot of them, but they come and go. People send different people. I have no problem with them working off a list, especially in a case like this where almost everybody got to ask a question.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, it was Obama who was the first to do that. And he called off of it almost looked like a set of Delaney cards that my high school homeroom teacher had. But, you know, I believe there may have been a more surreptitious reason, but I think the primary reason was to have a little decorum in the room. And when we saw what happened in the last half hour or so of this press conference with Biden, when they all started getting up and screaming at him at the same time, and he had to calm them down. And so if he wants to make the press look bad, have them look like pigs in a pig pen yelling at each other. So I think that's the history of it. But I don't know why the TV networks don't have somebody sitting next to the producer or the director identifying these people and then them running the name on the screen. They usually only do that when it's their own reporter. So it does not serve the public well. I'm sorry, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Ira Fussfeld, Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, and Rosemary Armeo with you. We do have one piece of mail this week, and it's a rather long one, so I'll try to edit it down as I go along. It's from Sharon in Troy, New York. She says she's a regular listener, and she was exacerbated by the Media Project last week as the panel squabbled about where listeners get their news, local and national, and Alan aired his familiar gripes about NPR. She describes herself as a 76-year-old and who reads a lot of news from print, and he listens to a lot of news on radio, a member of both local public radio stations in the area, and all the rest. But she didn't like the squabbling, and her bottom line is the important question is not who wins, radio or TV versus print, social media versus traditional outlets, but how to get the next generation to care about truth and know where to find it. I don't know if you've seen that letter, but your immediate thoughts of that. And then I thought, Alan, I don't want to put words in your mouth, or far be it from me to do that, but your criticisms about NPR have largely been about the business side of NPR, not the content that it provides. Is that fair?
For the most part, that is right, although there are some exceptions. There are times I think it does look a little shilly to me. I don't mean silly. I mean shilly, like they're shills for one position or another. But for the most part, I think the reporters are pretty good on NPR, and I certainly know that they're well paid. Take that as a shot if you like.
I was not on the panel, and so I'm not going to criticize any of my co-panelists this week for what they may or may not have. But I think her larger point, the writer's larger point of how do we get young people engaged in the news is a really important question. And I wish I had better answers. As a professor, I worry about that all the time. My students are simply not concerned with the news. It's not what medium at all. They'll look at headlines on the phone. That's it. To get them involved in issues like voter rights or the imminent invasion of Ukraine, it's very difficult. I'm about to teach a course on global perspectives on the news, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. These are kids who can't find Ukraine on a map, much less know why it's important, or if it is, to the United States. So I think her question is a good one that I hope smarter journalists than I have better answers for.
Judy, what do you think?
Yeah, her point that we shouldn't be focused on who wins or loses in the media game, I don't think journalists generally are. We want journalism itself to prevail, to continue on. You know, the challenge of getting young people to care about current events or about politics or about the news is an age-old one. at the start of my career, back in the late 70s, we were worried about that. In the 60s, you had people concerned about the Vietnam War and young people, but I was a teenager in the 60s, and current events was not my favorite part of going to school, so it's a challenge. I think the innovations that the digital technology offers us in terms of being able to tell stories in a different way or draw people into things they should care about offers us new opportunities. We just have to take advantage of them. I think being aware of the problem is essential, and you know, the fact that we offer the Media Project as a podcast is at least a good thing. A lot of things are offered as podcasts. We need to do more on Instagram. I think we're trying that, but again, it's an age-old problem.
We thank Sharon of Troy, New York, for sending in her letter. If you'd like to comment on any or all of what we talk about here, media@wamc.org is the way to get to us. By the way, Rosemary alluded briefly to the hedge fund and the whole issue of what that means to newspapers in particular. 60 Minutes doesn't need me to pump up their ratings, but if you're listening to the Media Project this week on Sunday night, 60 Minutes is going to have a spot on just that subject, local journalism. And according to the clip I saw promoted last week, hedge funds are going to come up. So that will be an appointment, a watch for me anyway. As soon as I take a shower after listening to this program.
What? I know. Ira, what are you saying?
Well, I don't know. It depends on how much heat I get the last 10 minutes. Public media, private media, two of Chicago's best-known media brands are tying the knot as WBEZ's Public Radio Board of Directors has voted unanimously to acquire the Chicago Sun-Times. The acquisition would create a new journalistic powerhouse pairing the city's award-winning, top-rated morning news station with the gritty tabloid made famous by its corruption-busting investigations, Roger Ebert's movie reviews, and Herb Cups in its gossip column, as well as crisp sports writing. Alan, what do you think of this in general, and do you ever see WAMC getting into this kind of an arrangement?
I don't. Would I want to be a partner of either excellent or not excellent papers in our region? No, I wouldn't. I think everybody running their own game is productive for everybody. I mean, the one thing you don't want to do is see too much combination. Now, I don't live in Chicago, and I really don't know much. But the newspaper is not their number one newspaper, right, Ira?
Yeah, I believe the Chicago Tribune is still the bigger paper, but the Chicago Tribune was recently purchased by the aforementioned hedge fund, so we don't know how that's going to come out long term.
I think this is a fabulous development. I was shocked and happily surprised by it. WBEZ and the Chicago Tribune have long been aligned in joint investigations. In the 1980s, they did the Mirage investigation, which some of it's still my favorite investigation, where together the reporters from the station and the paper bought a bar, the Mirage Bar, and they watched all of the crooked inspectors come in and shake them down for bribes, and they documented all this. It was a fabulous piece of immersive undercover journalism. And this is a fine tradition to continue, and far, far better than to have a hedge fund come in, which is concerned, as hedge funds are, with making money. And that generally means cutting out all investigations, which are expensive and time-consuming, cutting back reporters. It is a boost to local journalism. In Chicago, both the station and the newspaper have already committed to doing more stuff on elections, on coverage at the local level. This is really, I can't see this as anything but great news, and I'm very curious to see how it comes out. And it may be in a year or two when we ask Alan about this, he'll say, yeah, well, now I'm considering, having seen what happened in Chicago. I hope so.
Right. Very good idea and very good point. I'm capable, of course, as you well know, of changing my mind. Nevertheless, one wonders whether these two could not have cooperated and continue to cooperate as they are. The idea of a monolithic media group taking over, it bothers me a little bit. And I love the idea that there will be a certain amount of competition. For example, Judy's newspaper, the Schenectady paper, which did so well. And it competed, let's face it, whether you like it or not, it competed with the Times Union of Albany. Maybe not in Put Up Your Dukes, I'm going to punch you in the face. But there was competition for who got the story. And so I'm somewhat concerned that if you do too much in the way of combination, you get a bad outcome.
Well, it seems clear that the Sun-Times needs this more than does public radio in Chicago, which has apparently a very good nest egg. It's been a nonprofit. And I'm reminded, again, I don't want to put words in Alan's mouth, but when WAMC was invented 30-some-odd years ago, it was the small guy in town, and the print operations far out dwarfed it. And the tables have largely turned. The print operations are still large, but are decreasing, and the WAMC network is really grown and is a solid base financially. And I don't think you can say that about the Sun-Times or many other print newspapers outside of the Washington Post and the New York Times.
All good points, Ira.
So there have been these collaborations over the last several decades because radio and television people bring talents and skills that newspaper people don't have, and newspaper people bring their own skills. And so collaborations work from that aspect. But the idea of taking two voices and making one voice is concerning. And I think what we have to look at is the bottom line in terms of, are they saving money and how are they saving money? Are they saving money by cutting staff and cutting coverage? And that would be one thing that I would be concerned about. I love the collaborations, but as we move into where everybody's doing everything, radio stations just used to do voice, but now they're posting writing on their websites. Newspapers are doing more than writing. They're doing podcasts. They're doing video. So we're all doing the same thing. So as that trend continues, there will be increased competition, and everybody may want to stand on their own, or you may see this merger. The market we're in, the capital region of New York State, we have a lot of different news producers, and competition is good. One station will get a story that someone else might not have even have thought of doing. So I watch it warily. I love collaboration, but I'm a little wary.
And to its credit, and I hate to say this because then I'm saying too many nice things about Alan, but WAMC has long reached out to the local and regional print media to provide commentary and folks for programs such as this one. And it doesn't create dollars in our pockets, but it does give the newspapers some branding and some exposure. And that's a good thing. And at the same time, it has helped WAMC by getting these additional voices on its air.
You know, Ira, you are absolutely right. And I got to say that in the old days, there was a certain reticence sometimes about newspapers and others putting their people on public radio and other places. Now, that has changed dramatically. Everybody's fighting for a place at the table. We love having them, but it has changed.
And I think it's to both sides' benefit. Judy or Rosemary, a final word?
You know, one of the reasons that we didn't like to do radio before is because we're not very good at it. We're mostly skilled at writing, not at talking. So yeah, it took us a little while to get up to speed on that one, Alan.
Yeah,
we'll have to leave it up to the listeners to see if they believe we've gotten better at it based on this program. Rosemary?
Yeah, I wish I had started in radio. I had no idea it could be this much fun.
Well, we're just having a great old time, but the time has come to a close. So I want to thank everyone for listening, first of all, and for joining us, Alan Shartok, Judy Patrick, Rosemary Romeo. I'm Ira Fussfeld. Thanks to our producer, David Gustina. And join us again next week for another edition of The Media Project.
Now, newspaper men are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a...
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rosemary Armeo is an investigative journalist and adjunct professor at the University at Albany. Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.